shoes?
What's the matter, Morty?
Coral, the string.
Turn to my old dress.
Coral, the string.
Great gowns.
Coral,
beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to the Every Outfit Podcast.
Today we are doing a mailbag episode. We will be joined later in the episode by our friend Ione Gamble from Polyester Magazine. But first, Lauren has a very important announcement.
No, I just wanted to update you about the Sarah Jessica Parker jalapeno wine of it all, because it is out.
Really?
Well, there's a caveat. I checked our local Total Wine in West Hollywood. It is not in the West Hollywood store. So I went online. They will not deliver it either. It is available in some stores. So I was like, all right, I'll go to Woodland Hills to pick up this jalapeno wine. Chelsea, the closest Total Wine that has it is in Wisconsin.
Is there a high demand for Sarah Jessica Parker jalapeno infused wine in Wisconsin?
I do not know.
Pairs nicely with a cheddar.
I did find a website called Wine Anthology that does have it, so I will order it and we'll finally get to see what this is all about.
See, I've been checking Postmates like every other day to see if it's at Total Wine. There's actually lots of places around here that stock In Vivo x Sarah Jessica Parker, which is the broader wine, I guess, sub-label that they created with Sarah Jessica Parker.
Oh, don't get me wrong, Chelsea. You can find the Pinot Noir at the West Hollywood Total Wine, but the jalapeno wine, I guess there's not much of a demand for it. But I did want to shout out, because when we first talked about Sarah Jessica Parker's spicy wine, a fuckette named Ray, her husband, slid into our DMs to tell us that he made a Serrano-infused olive oil that goes very well with a martini, and he asked if he could send us some. We have tried it. It is incredible. The packaging is incredible. I have not tried it in a martini yet, but I drizzled it on an heirloom tomato salad and it was great. I think Tat used it to make some fish the other night.
Not you being a hot oil influencer.
I don't know about that. So it's called Rossi's Hot Oil. We will put a link in our show notes to it. This is a fuckette produced Every Outfit approved product.
We should design our own seal like they have for the Allure Beauty Awards.
Every Outfit approved.
Best of beauty.
We'll get on it.
Okay, let's start with some Sex and the City questions. We got some good ones. I love this one in particular. Which Sex and the City character would have the most insufferable social media presence?
I mean, the obvious answer is Charlotte. As we saw on And Just Like That, she had an Instagram dedicated to her dog. But I think it may low-key be Samantha, because I feel like her social media would just constantly be filled with promoting her clients' work. Like, I wouldn't follow Samantha, but I would have to mute her.
I think she would just post thirst traps. I actually don't think that she would be that annoying. Miranda, I don't think would have any sort of presence. Like, I think she would just be a lurker. Carrie, obviously prone to long and dramatic captions for sure, but I feel like the fashion content would make it worth it. So yes, I agree with you. Charlotte would be hard, if for no other reason than she would be really concerned about what other people think. So her social media would probably be boring. And I can also see her doing that thing that I really hate, where people like post a carousel and then the caption is like, slide one, a night out with the girls.
Oh boy.
Slide two, my sprinkle matcha or like whatever it is.
But she wouldn't know how to format it in a way where it just goes from line to line. It's just like one block of text.
We're being so rude to Charlotte, but who cares? She's a fictional character.
Okay. Thoughts on the Phoebe Philo flower brooch?
I love it and would love to own it.
Yeah, my thoughts about the flower brooch kind of extend to every piece of Phoebe Philo, clothing, accessories, shoes, sunglasses. If you can afford it, go buy it.
I just could not justify spending $1,000 on such a thing.
$1,395 to be exact, which might be the most affordable thing that Phoebe Philo offers.
No, you can definitely get sunglasses and stuff like that for like $500. But yes, it is a piece on the lower end of the price spectrum for sure. Although it is very large.
to riff on Tom Wobbskans from Succession, it's a ludicrously colossal flower brooch.
Yeah, it's not like one of those like tiny ass Chanel camellias or something.
Well, the way that it is styled on the model on the website, it's like affixed to the top of a blazer. So it sort of looks like an organza goiter.
Look, for the girlies on a budget, if you want to replicate the look, I just want to suggest M&S Schmalberg, which is the last remaining flower factory in the United States. This is where Patricia Field got all of the flower brooches that Carrie wore on Sex in the City. And they do have an online store. And I think the most expensive ones they sell, maybe like $80 for something crazy, but most of them are more in the $20, $30 zone.
Thanks for the hot tip. Okay. Which outfit is considered iconic but is actually bad?
What do you think?
Well, if we're going with personal preference, like this is not a bad outfit per se. I've just never fucked with the pink Oscar de la Renta dress that Petrovsky got Carrie in season 6.
Oh, I disagree. I love that dress.
That's what I'm saying, personal preference. But if we're going for an objectively bad Carrie outfit that people think is amazing, I think I would go with the Chanel logo blouse that she wears to meet the comic book guy.
Okay, hard disagree, but to each their own.
But hear me out. People think it's iconic because of the Chanel blouse, but if you take the outfit as a whole, if you remember what it is styled with a teal bandana, and then these, they're not tie-dye capris, but they're sort of these purple and pink ombre capris. As a whole, it's not a good outfit, and I think it's considered iconic because of the Chanel top.
I think it's considered iconic because most people think that it is a really bad outfit. I disagree with that read. I think it's an incredible outfit. I think I like it because it's clearly very inspired by the fashions of the Bronx, but also it feels very stonery to me in a weird way.
It is the soul of Patricia Field as an outfit. But what do you think is a bad outfit then?
I think a bad outfit is the white Halston dress and the gold mirrored aviator sunglasses that Carrie wears in Sex and the City 2. I would say this is the most iconic outfit from that film, or one of a few.
I would agree.
I think it's bad. I think it looks like it's from Kohl's. I'm not into it.
This is when Sarah Jessica Parker was involved with reviving Halston, right?
Yeah, I think this was product placement. But to me, the dress didn't feel very Carrie.
No.
She had some other good moments in Halston. Like, I think her Met Gala look during that tenure was good.
Oh, we're extending this to Sarah Jessica Parker now.
No, I'm just saying not all Sarah Jessica Parker Halston revival outfits are bad, but this one I believe is bad.
All right. If Carrie had been prescribed ADHD meds in season 1, would season 2 through 6 have been boring as fuck? I love the framing of this question because it's presupposing that we all agree that Carrie has ADHD.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what personality traits that she has that could point to that. There's a level of disorganization, like even the way she like drops her handbag on the street when she first meets Mr. Big and stuff. And she has been known to be late.
But are we trying to say that if she was on Adderall, she wouldn't have had an affair with Mr. Big?
Here's the thing. If she did have ADHD and she was on Adderall, it wouldn't completely change her personality. It would help her manage her symptoms, but it would not fundamentally change this crazy ass bitch. We know people on these meds, they're basically the same, with slightly more executive functioning.
I was going to say, I'm married to a man with ADHD who is medicated, and I can tell you that that does not preclude someone from having bouts of executive dysfunction and hyper focus on tasks that some would say are not important.
Yeah, well, I live with an unmedicated spouse with ADHD, so I win.
So no, I don't think Carrie being on ADHD meds, even if she were, which I love this invented lore, would have made her boring as fuck. I think she would have made as chaotic personal and professional decisions. We are thrilled to be back to discuss one of our favorite sponsors, Reddit.
You know, Reddit was an indispensable resource for today's episode.
Yes, listeners often ask how we prepare for episodes, and sometimes the answer is Reddit. Like, for me, r/popculturechat is how I keep abreast of the daily and honestly hourly comings and goings of celebrity culture.
Well, Reddit is the app for authentic conversations about anything and everything. If you can think of it, there's probably a subreddit for it.
What I love about Reddit is one minute I can be digging into fan theories on r/widowsbay, and then the next minute I can find meal ideas for Morty on baby-led weaning. On Reddit, you get a conversation, different perspectives, thoughtful questions, and honest debate that can help me see things more clearly, or decide that sometimes a PB&J sandwich is the perfect dinner choice for my one-year-old.
You know, it wasn't until I discovered r/luxurycandles that I learned that there were many other people, a whole community in fact, that really care about the issues that plague the candle community. Tunneling, inadequate throw, questionable wax formulations.
If I want honest reviews, behind-the-scenes insights on shows I love, or help figuring something out, Reddit is the first place I go to.
There's the Reddit app, which everyone should download, but beyond that, I love that they give me a curated homepage which suggests other subreddits that I might be interested in based on subreddits I've already been to.
Whatever question you're dealing with, whatever problem you're stuck on, Reddit already has the answers. Download the Reddit app and get answers on everything from baby-led weaning to luxury candles. Download the Reddit app today.
Okay, next question. One of my favorite scenes is when Maria breaks Samantha's plates. Tell me what you would do in that situation.
Well, given my reaction to our harasser during the backroom screening, I guess nothing. Look, I don't think I would actively engage with Maria while there's porcelain shards flying everywhere.
See, I know exactly what I would do. I would lock my doors and I would call a domestic violence hotline. Because, like, on Sex and the City, this is a comedic scene, but in the real world, I believe this would be considered intimate partner violence. And I am not on board for that.
Of course not. Well, to try to give a funny answer to this, I think I would have shouted, like, what the fuck, several times. But after the third plate crashed, I think I would have just let Maria run her course and then send her a bill for new plates.
Send her the CB2 registry. I honestly wouldn't care if someone broke my plates. I'm over them. I need a refresh in that department, I think.
So possibly she did Samantha a favor?
I feel like when Samantha moved to that meatpacking district, she just like got all new everything, you know?
I guess the bigger question is, did Maria stop at the plates? Did she continue into the glassware? Was she throwing flatware? You know, or by the time she was done with the plate, she was like, all right, I'm done, which would be embarrassing. Like, it's a funny scene, as you said, but like, if you are actively having an unhinged moment, there's no way to sort of end those moments equally at a high point.
True. Okay, we have a call.
Hi, Lauren and Chelsea. Long time, first time. This is Sandra from Minneapolis. I had to ask, have you heard of Sex Change and the City, edited by Tuck Woodstock and Nico Stratus? I just found it at my local queer bookstore, and I need to hear your take on it, because there's lots of fun stuff in here, including a drawing of Aiden fucking Steve, and a fanfic to go along with it. So let me know what you think. Bye.
I had not heard of this book until I received this call. I was able to download a PDF of the book from their publisher. And I will say, this book is genius. And I am very offended that I was not asked to contribute.
Yes. So the book is described as featuring personal essays, critical analysis, comics, poetry, artwork, games, and steamy short stories by 45 fabulous trans and queer contributors. I went through this PDF. Thank you for finding it and sending it to me. We, of course, will buy copies of this.
Yes, I just didn't have time to do that.
What was your favorite piece?
Well, I didn't read the whole book, so I can't speak to that. But the things I liked, the fictional letter from Pedro Almodovar to Michael Patrick King, which was written by Connor Reed. I loved that. I loved the comic that was basically like Stanford having a full imaginary conversation with the Mary Queen of Scots doll. And I also loved the bit at the beginning where they basically polled all of the contributors from this book and asked them like which Sex and the City character would be most likely to start hormone replacement therapy. Miranda was the clear winner. But, you know, Samantha also got a significant amount of votes. And the theory was raised that she is a stealth trans woman, which is also basically what SNL said.
With the infamous Christina Aguilera sketch, yeah. I mean, I think the point was made that she is on hormone replacement therapy quite literally in the second film. Unsurprisingly, my favorite essay was Brie LaRose's piece connecting Sex and the City to The Real Housewives of New York in an essay called SATC, The Real Housewives and the Rage of Middle Age. As the caller referenced, there is an illustration of Aiden fucking Steve. And no disrespect to this artist, Sarah Eskoff, but Aiden's face does look remarkably like David Duchovny. I also had this bizarre visceral reaction where I was like, I think Steve would be fucking Aiden. And then I read the caption, and the caption notes that most of the feedback for the artist was that same exact thought.
You aren't alone.
Okay, let's get into some pop culture questions. Thoughts on Jussie Smollett and Karamo?
A match made in heaven.
Yeah, this falls into a sure why not category. They both seem to be messy public figures. So in that respect, they're perfect for each other.
Yeah, although Jussie is way messier than Karamo.
Correct. I think the biggest red flag for me is just the speed of how I'm seeing this relationship. Like, there was a paparazzi photo at the beginning of the week of them hiking Runyon or Fryman, one of those places. But I've now seen them saying goodbye to each other at LAX. There was a podcast appearance where Karamo says that Jussie Smollett is the one. It's just like, guys, this is a lot for 1 week. Like, save this rollout for over a month or two.
Well, they both have stunt queen tendencies, and that is why they are basically the new Chris Appleton in Lucas Gage.
Good call. Yeah.
They have a similar level of fame, and this union, like Chris Appleton and Lucas Gage, will only make both of them more famous.
Now, the question becomes, how fast do they get married? Because I think Chris Appleton and Lucas Gage, was that a couple months of dating?
That was very, very fast. I definitely think that they will walk down the aisle. And honestly, I hope that they are together forever. I don't think they can break up, because can you imagine how fucking messy that would be?
I mean, I'm not excited for people to divorce, but now you're making me excited for a fast wedding and an even quicker, incredibly messy divorce.
The divorce media cycle could be really insufferable, though. Although we might get into it. It's hard to say.
I mean, for the first week, sure, but months on end, I don't think so.
But, like, they both seem to be the kind of, like, rise and grind types who love a motivational quote, you know? Like, they love a protein shake. They're kind of a bit more spiritual than religious. I can see this. Like, I can see this working. I just think that because they're so similar in certain respects that it might, like, blow up in their faces later. But I wish them the best.
I could definitely see a reality show with the two of them.
Oh, for sure. And their, like, surrogacy journey.
Oh, boy. All right. Other relationships we may or may not care about. Do we care about Kendall and Jacob Elordi?
To quote the great Beyoncé Knowles, I care.
Go on.
They aren't particularly dramatic celebrities, so it's not exciting in that Jussie Karamo sort of way, but the union itself makes sense. They are both hot. They are both tall. They are like the sized up version of Timmy and Kylie.
Yeah. I mean, what I care more about is it is now clear that Jacob Elordi lied about having a foot injury to get out of being on the jury for the Cannes Film Festival just so he could go to Hawaii with Kendall. Not cool, Jacob.
Not cool, but not the worst thing that he could do.
I do look forward to Kendall, like Kylie, having to pretend to care about Jacob's film projects. Like, Jacob's latest film project is some post-apocalyptic film by Ridley Scott. Like, imagine Kendall having to make conversation with 80-something-year-old Ridley Scott at the after party.
I think she could hack it, but I know what you're saying. Like, I even found it awkward the fact that, like, Kylie Jenner had to see Willy Wonka probably more than once. You know, I do wonder if Jacob Elordi's name will end up on the Kris Jenner gingerbread house come this holiday season.
Right, right, right.
But we shall see. All right. A question for me. Chelsea, what are your thoughts on The Testaments?
So this is the spinoff to The Handmaid's Tale.
Yes.
Is it a prequel?
No, it takes place after the events of The Handmaid's Tale. And it is truly my dream premise for a show because it is set at an all-girls high school in Gilead.
Okay.
It's like teen Handmaid's Tale. Chase Infinity is the lead. She is incredible. And it's about her and her like little clique of friends at this school. Like she has the lesbian best friend that's in love with her. There's the Charlotte. Rowan Blanchard plays kind of like a bitchy popular girl.
I have not heard that name in a minute.
And if it wasn't set in Gilead, like this would actually be my dream school because they aren't allowed to read or anything like that, in this world. So they can't like learn about anything. So they spend all of their time like playing the harp and like painting and like beekeeping and shit. Which I would love if I was a teenage girl.
Right. In a world where you have free will as a woman.
Sure. But I think it's a good show because it's less fucked up and violent than The Handmaid's Tale was. Handmaid's Tale season one was perfect. Season two into three, it like ventured into Saw torture porn territory that I think alienated a lot of the original audience.
And then, not that I ever regularly watch The Handmaid's Tale, but that last season debuted like years after the previous season to the point where I think a lot of people like myself thought the show was over.
Right. Not me. I stuck in with that show until the bitter end. And Elizabeth Moss is on The Testaments intermittently, but like it's kind of not necessary. Like it takes me out of the world whenever she's on the show, although Anne Dowd is like a series regular and is in every single episode. And she's still major, obviously.
I love that kind of working actor where she's like, oh, a sequel to the series? Yeah, I'll do that. A prequel? You can DH me. I'll also be in that. Rebooting The Handmaid's Tale? I'll also be in that.
I hope one day we get like a Muppet Babies-esque Gilead spinoff.
Jesus.
The Children of Gilead.
Let's be honest, who isn't going through it at the moment? It's rough out there. Now, I'm a big proponent for therapy, but sometimes even I can acknowledge that that isn't the whole answer. That's where Talkiatry comes in. Talkiatry gives you access to real psychiatric care with licensed clinicians who can diagnose and prescribe medication if it's right for you. It's a simple way to get effective treatment right from home. Talkiatry is a 100% online psychiatry practice that provides comprehensive evaluations, diagnoses, and provides ongoing medication management for conditions like ADHD, anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, OCD, PTSD, insomnia. Unlike therapy-only platforms, Talkiatry is psychiatry. You are seeing a medical provider who can diagnose mental health conditions and prescribe medication when it's appropriate. I have so many friends who have ADHD who could not find consistent medication management, and I've told them all about Talkiatry. As I've said before, I suffer from postpartum anxiety, and it was impossible to find a psychiatrist to help prescribe the medication I needed. I really wish I knew about Talkiatry then. All 800-plus clinicians are in-network with major insurers, so you can use your existing insurance instead of paying monthly subscriptions or out-of-network costs. You can meet with a licensed psychiatrist who takes the time to understand what's going on, builds a personalized treatment plan, and supports you over time with consistent evidence-based care. Getting started takes just a few minutes. Complete a short online assessment, get matched with clinicians who fit your needs, and schedule your first visit in days, not months. And because you continue with the same provider, you're not starting over each visit. Your treatment can evolve with you, so you're actually making progress over time. More than 300,000 patients have already found high-quality psychiatric care through Talkiatry. Head to talkiatry.com/outfit to complete the short assessment and get matched with an in-network psychiatrist in just a few minutes. That's talkiatry.com/outfit to get matched in minutes. Okay, thoughts on Widow's Bay. Are you watching this?
I have not seen it, and I don't even know what it's about, so explain everything.
Okay. Widow's Bay is a show that took me a while to get into. It has Matthew Rhys yet again playing an American, not to be confused with the show he was on, The Americans. It is a small New England island that is not Martha's Vineyard that at the start of the series, Matthew Rhys is courting a New York Times columnist to come and write a piece about their island, Widow's Bay, to make it the new Martha's Vineyard. And Stephen Root plays a sailor who doesn't want this to happen because the town is cursed. And Matthew Rhys doesn't believe that the town is cursed. And guess what? The town is cursed. But it is quite funny. It took me a while to get through the first two episodes because I just couldn't understand what the tone was. But the word of mouth has been so good that I just pushed through. And there is an episode, I think it's the fourth episode with the breakout character, Patricia, that is so good. It is the first show that's given me the same feeling I had when watching Buffy, where it is an authentically good horror show, but it is making fun of horror tropes, but it is actually funny.
Okay, sold. This sounds amazing.
You would like it. It is created by Katie Dippold, who wrote the female Ghostbusters film. She was a writer on Parks and Rec. It has been described as, like, imagine whatever horror-esque show you want to put in or movie. Like, imagine it's Parks and Rec meets It.
Okay, I'm down for that.
But what's funny is most people know Katie Dippold, especially if you are chronically online, because have you ever seen the Babadook meme of the person that dressed up as the Babadook for a Halloween party, but no one else dressed up?
No.
That is Katie Dippold. That is a tweet she posted. And that is how a lot of people have gotten into the show of like, oh, the Babadook tweet woman? All right, I'm in.
I love that. Okay, next question. Did you watch Tina Fey's series, The Four Seasons?
I haven't.
I watched both seasons.
Okay. There's no reason for me not to watch the show. Like, I do love the premise. I love all the clips that I've seen. I just haven't started watching it. I think partially because I'm married to a straight guy. There's just not a lot of overlap in what we will watch together.
Lauren, there is straight male representation on this show.
Good to know. Because all I've seen are clips of Coleman Domingo and Tina Fey, which have made me laugh hysterically.
No, it's Steve Carell and what's his face? Will Forte, yeah. Who honestly, his character like really fucking annoys me. And that's the thing about this show. Like, it is like the streaming version of The Big Chill for Gen X. So it's kind of cheesy, but it's also just like very comforting to watch. And it does have its moments. The format of it is good because there's 8 episodes per season, and then there's 2 episodes devoted to each season of the year. So you come into these people's lives summer, fall, spring, winter, and that's the format of the show.
Not in that order.
Wait, oh my God.
You did okay, spring, summer.
I'm fucking brain dead, guys.
No, I love it.
No, we can keep it in.
Chelsea doesn't know when my birthday is. We've discussed this on the podcast.
I do too. It's the day after 420.
But you often, as an explanation, have been like, I get my spring months mixed up.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what month 4 indicates, but
Chelsea is unaware. She believes March, that April. March, May, April is how it goes.
No, okay. This is actually really bad. I don't know if I've ever talked about this, but yeah, I don't know if March or April, like which one comes first, and I never have. And I literally can't tell the difference between those months.
And you never will.
I never will. I can wrap my head around February and I can wrap my head around May. What happens in between those months? Who fucking knows? Okay, one more thing that I want to say. The dynamics between the couples on the show are realistic, like scarily realistic. And yeah, I like Coleman Domingo and Marco Calvani, who plays his Italian boyfriend. They are very cute. And Tina Fey is cute. Will Forte, deeply annoying.
Will Forte, sashay away. So no one asked us this, but we of course have to talk about it because we have breaking news. The limited series about JonBenet Ramsey, where Melissa McCarthy and Clive Owen were playing JonBenet Ramsey's parents, which was supposed to air on Paramount Plus, has landed somewhere. It has landed on Netflix. It has been reported that it will probably come out time to the 30th anniversary of JonBenet Ramsey's death, which was in December, which is incredibly dark.
Yes, they say that it will be released in the winter. Since it's a limited series, I imagine this would be coming out in possibly late October, but likely early November, if they're going to blow through 8 or 10 episodes or something before the 30th anniversary of her death, which is on the 25th/26th.
No doubt we will be devoting, if not an exclusive episode to this, probably several episodes to this.
Yeah, for sure. The people in the subreddit are not optimistic.
About the limited series being good?
They fear that it will be Ramsey family propaganda, which tends to be the vibe because they are so litigious.
I don't know, because the whole thing, just to go back, if people don't remember, is Paramount Plus, which is under the banner of Viacom, which also owns CBS, The Ramseys sued CBS famously after the Dr. Phil interview, and so Paramount Plus presumably got worried that they would face another expensive lawsuit, so they decided not to air the series. This negotiation, according to Deadline, has been going on for months. Presumably, Netflix's legal department did their due diligence to make sure that they don't get sued within an inch of their life. I mean, they're already facing the Tyra Banks lawsuit.
Which means that it's not possible to tell this story. They also renamed the show. Because remember, before it was called Unspeakable, I think the death of JonBenet Ramsey, when it was still at Paramount, now it is the murder of JonBenet Ramsey.
Only time will tell. You know that Chelsea, and therefore myself, will be breathlessly covering every episode. I'm thrilled to welcome Momentous back as one of today's sponsors. Creatine is one of the most researched and effective supplements available, but as the category has exploded, most brands have focused on flavors, formats, and marketing instead of actually making the creatine itself better. That's why Momentous created Signature Spec Creatine, their most advanced creatine ever, setting a new standard for creatine quality.
I'm also here because while this may surprise our audience, I have recently re-embarked on a fitness journey for the millionth time, and I've finally discovered the importance of creatine. Did you know that creatine isn't just for building muscle? Creatine is even more essential for women who naturally store about 70 to 80% less creatine than men, which means consistent supplementation can have an even greater impact on energy, recovery, and focus, which means that I'm not super haggard after my spitting class, thank God.
Momentous Signature Spec Creatine is one of the only creatines to be manufactured in a pharmaceutical facility using reverse osmosis, water purification, and verified through an expanded six-stage testing process with four independent agencies. And that means Momentous Creatine delivers 10 times fewer impurities, 2 to 5 times tighter heavy metal limits, PFAS, and microplastic screenings.
I don't know about all that, but I do know that the Signature Spec Creatine is an ultra-fine powder that mixes effortlessly with no grit or clumping.
I was taking Momentous's creatine chews, but have switched to their new Signature Spec Creatine. I take it first thing in the morning with 8 ounces of water. In less than 5 minutes, I'm hydrated, and I've supported my cognitive and muscle performance all before my morning coffee.
The benefits of creatine are real. It supports strength, power, lean muscle, growth, recovery, and even improved cognitive performance, which I clearly need after today's episode. So if you're going to take creatine every day, make sure that it's the best. Choose Momentous Signature Spec Creatine. Wow, I've truly said creatine so many times.
If you want to try Momentous's Signature Spec Creatine, head to livemomentous.com and use code OUTFIT for up to 35% off your first order. That's livemomentous.com, promo code OUTFIT for up to 35% off. livemomentous.com, promo code OUTFIT.
Okay, we got a call that was too long to play, but a listener that is our self-described cowgirl correspondent brought it to our attention in the nicest way possible that because we are coastal elites, we are not covering a lot of entertainment stories that Middle America fucks with.
Middle America fuckettes. And geographically, she is correct. We have only ever lived on the East and West Coast.
So for that reason, we will discuss Jelly Roll's divorce.
I mean, I don't have a ton to say about Jelly Roll's divorce. This is the other thing, is a lot of the things she listed, we just don't have a ton to say.
Okay, I have a ton to say about Jelly Roll's divorce. RIP love, love is dead. If they can't figure it out, no one can. Give up now. Like, this is sad.
Did you also learn about the divorce from a TikTok clip of his now ex, Bunny, discussing the fact that they were getting a divorce on her podcast?
That's not how I found out, but yes, I did see some clips of Bunny XO, his soon-to-be ex.
However, she was like, we're still best friends, which is always the line that people, especially celebrities, say when they get divorced. But in one of the clips I saw, she was like, guys, we're still having a child together. I'm like, ooh, maybe don't do that.
To each their own. I think they're going to work it out.
Oh, boy.
Because they've been together for a really long time. Like, she held him down when he was not famous, when he was a full-blown, like, drug addict, like, chugging lean all the time. She also had substance abuse issues. And they both helped each other get through those issues. They've been having fertility issues that have been really difficult, that have impacted their marriage. Very sad, obviously. I believe they are now pursuing surrogacy.
I believe so, correct. The clip that I saw from her own podcast, Bunny XO was saying she can be kind of immature in fights. While they were having a fight, she was like, fine, let's just get a divorce. And then Jelly Roll proceeded on the divorce.
Well, they apparently got into this huge fight on Mother's Day, which is sad given the infertility issues.
Right. You know?
I really hope that they can work it out one day. I think they will. I have faith in these people, in this union. Like, this is like true love.
One of the things that this caller shouted out, our cowgirl correspondent, was how we never talk about any Taylor Sheridan show. And I just want to say, I know all that goes on the Taylor Sheridan shows, The Madison, Dutton Ranch, and Landman, because my parents watch these shows and they tell me about every plot detail when I see them. So I could have my mother on. You know who also loves Jelly Roll? My mom.
I'd love to know what she thinks of Jelly Roll's new caps.
I'm sure she has a lot of opinions. I will give this caller, I did not know about this Dolly Parton truck stop.
I didn't know about that either.
Well, because we're coastal elite.
Yes, because I don't live in Connersville, Tennessee, which is where this truck stop is located. The logo for the truck stop is really good. It is like a mud flap girl version of Dolly Parton. But the gift shop and the restaurant look quite generic. Like, it looks like any truck stop, or maybe a truck stop that's a little bit on the Hard Rock Cafe spectrum, because there's like a chandelier made of electric guitars.
I was looking at the website for Dolly Parton's truck stop, and like a lot of truck stops, there are showers for truckers or long haul drivers. But I noticed that there was story time, which I thought was cute.
That is cute. But I just like hate that like all of Dolly Parton's things like do not reflect her aesthetic, you know, and I get it. The truck stop can't be girly and glittery because it is for literal truckers. But like,
not to say that there aren't female truckers,
high femme truckers. But like with Dollywood, like the branding is so good, like the whole butterfly logo and stuff. But like the Dollywood theme park itself is not that like photogenic or not that like Dolly adjacent, you know?
I hear what you're saying. I guess we need to go on a road trip just to go to the Dolly Parton truck stop. Okay. A question that only Chelsea can answer, which is, Chelsea, will you be buying the Miley Cyrus Barbie?
I'm good on that front. It looks like 2026 Miley, which means that it does not look like Miley Cyrus from previous eras.
Well, I did take a look at this Barbie doll, and my question to you was going to be, what era of Miley is this supposed to be? Because her outfit is very her style now, but it's a bizarre haircut that is brown, which is what I don't associate, at least for the last 15 years, Miley Cyrus. Like, I associate her as being blonde.
That's what I'm saying. I think she did that hair for her last album, but we weren't really closely paying attention to what she was doing.
Right.
Like, if they had made a Barbie doll of, like, her in the like crazy bear bodysuit from that VMA performance in the Bangers era, like I would have bought that because it would have looked like Miley on some level.
Right. So not every specialty Barbie is a Barbie you must own.
Okay, so we got an unusual amount of Celesbian questions. Let's start with this call.
Hi girls. Sorry if I'm late to this topic, but would love to hear your thoughts on Robbie Hoffman. I know she got some backlash after her Call Her Daddy episode and just kind of seeing a lot of discourse about her on social media. So wanted to get your two cents. Thanks. Bye.
I knew that there was some controversy about her recent Call Her Daddy appearance. And when I looked online, there was like mudslinging that she was misogynistic or something. I could not have predicted that the controversy was about disregarding the severity of the plight of those with celiac disease.
I know. What a crazy thing to get canceled for. She basically said that she didn't believe that celiac was real unless she could see someone have like an immediate dramatic reaction. And like, this is not to say that I don't believe in celiac disease. Obviously I do, but this is just like not that bad of a thing to say.
Oh my God, no. On the scale of things to get canceled for, this is such a light offense. Also, One of my best friends genuinely has celiac disease. And you know what offends her the most? When people pretend they have celiac disease and are like, oh, I can't eat gluten. Like, it is an issue for those who genuinely can't eat gluten. But for a lot of people, it's kind of like, remember the episode where Carrie doesn't want parsley on a dish or cilantro? Right. And so she goes as far to say that she's allergic to it just because she doesn't want a little bit of it on the plate. Like, it's kind of like that.
Yeah.
Are we now going to get canceled?
No, no. Well, the thing is, it went beyond celiac disease. People were then basically like, you don't believe that invisible illnesses are real. And I just want to say, there will be a point that we will come to very soon where no celebrities will give real interviews anymore, because you will not be able to speak freely at all about anything. We know that Timothy Chalamet is never going to give an interesting interview again after the opera and ballet comments. I think that in the future, when celebrities go on podcasts to promote stuff, it is going to be increasingly prescribed. Like, they will almost be acting. Like, they will have rehearsed certain materials. They will not even touch shit like this.
I thought of something darker, which is, I think eventually you're just going to have celebrities send AI agents of themselves. Like, studios are just going to feed interviews and performances of, like, Matt Damon and Anne Hathaway, and then, like, some avatar is going to show up to the press junket.
It's dark, but I can see it.
By the way, we haven't given our opinion about Robbie Hoffman at all.
Obsessed with Robbie Hoffman.
Yeah.
I think she's a genius. She's the lesbian Larry David, or perhaps the millennial Fran Lebowitz, however you want to think about it. I could listen to her talk about anything. And I think her material about the state of the queer community in particular is so funny and so smart. Although, of course, she, you know, annoys a lot of people.
I also saw people take out of context her recent appearance. I think it was on The Bald and the Beautiful. It was with Trixie Mattel, where she tells a story about how she got angry when she lost at the Emmys and stormed out, ha ha ha, when Jennifer Nicholson won over her, which was obviously a joke. But then, like, the New York Post wrote about it seriously, as if she wasn't being sarcastic. And then people just saw that headline and piled on of, like, fuck this person.
It's hard to be a comedian out in these streets. I did see Robbie Hoffman at a screening of Marty Supreme at the Grove, which was really an afternoon of Jewish excellence for me. And Tad and I did go up to her because we had just watched her Netflix special like a couple days earlier, and we complimented her, and she was so lovely and so cool. And I'm obsessed. And I, of course, am obsessed with her relationship also, like, in a parasocial way.
I was gonna say, was her wife with her?
Mm-hmm.
God, I would love to know her thoughts about Marty Supreme.
About celiac disease.
It's not real. That's my impression of Gabby Windy. Here on the Every Outfit Podcast, we love Cash App. From getting paid to growing what you've got, Cash App makes managing your money effortless and instant without all the fees. It's the way money should work. If you didn't already know, Cash App is way more than just a safe way to send and receive money. With the Cash App card, you unlock a ton of perks without all the hidden fees. Enjoy benefits like exclusive early access to nationwide concert presales, think Kendrick Lamar and Sabrina Carpenter to name a couple of recent examples, plus discounts on everyday purchases and popular brands you're probably already spending money on. Add your card to your digital wallet and make your money moves easier. And then there's Cash App's new status program for the way people actually spend, called Cash App Green. It unlocks new ways for you to pay, get rewarded, and easily grow or manage your money on your terms. Now, when you spend at least $500 a month with the Cash App card, you earn green status, which unlocks benefits like up to $200 of free overdraft coverage. And best yet, if you direct deposit at least $300 in paychecks each month and use the Cash App card for purchases, you can earn interest on your savings. No hidden fees, no minimum balance requirements. Also, you can hit your savings goals even faster by turning on roundups on your Cash App card. With roundups, every purchase you make using the card is rounded up to the nearest dollar, and that spare change is automatically put into your savings. Don't let your money sit around and gather dust. Make it work for you. Take advantage of interest savings on Cash App today. New Cash App customers can earn $10 if they use code CASHAPP10 in their profile at signup and send $5 to a friend within 14 days. Terms apply. Cash App is a financial services platform, not a bank. Banking services provided by Cash App's bank partners, prepaid debit cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC, Cash App Visa debit flex cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC, and the Bancorp Bank N.A. pursuant to a license from Visa USA Inc. See terms and conditions for the Sutton prepaid card, Sutton debit flex card, and the Bancorp debit flex card. Cash App Green features savings, direct deposit, roundups, overdraft coverage, and discounts provided by Cash App, a Block Inc. brand. Visit cash.app/legal/podcast for full disclosures. Okay, need your thoughts on Bjork's new girlfriend.
So we don't 100% know that this is actually her new girlfriend because this Icelandic musician named Yara Polana posted a photo on her Instagram stories of her and Bjork, and she wrote, "Couldn't ask for a better girlfriend." That is all the evidence that we have. We haven't seen any other photos of them. Bjork certainly hasn't confirmed this, although that isn't a very Bjork thing to do. She wouldn't. I am choosing to believe it because I love the idea of this couple. I can't imagine that studs are like super abundant in Iceland, so good for Bjork. This chick is really hot.
She's super cool. Yeah, according to her website, she's a local of 101 Reykjavik, Iceland, and a humble, multifaceted, multi-talented artist and tech nerd.
To be fair, I've only seen this one photo of her, but the outfit is on point.
So it was not exactly on my bingo card for 2026 for Bjork to have a girlfriend, but not surprised.
I swear to God, everyone is a late in life lesbian now. It's crazy.
Straight out of the L word.
Like, I just found out that Camille Badeau Waddington is a lesbian now.
What?
Identifies as a lesbian. Is dating Alice Temple.
Let's back up for 1 second for people that do not know this stylist of the 2000s that was very impactful on us. She was married to Jarvis Cocker.
She was married to Jarvis Cocker for a long time. It feels like only yesterday that I saw them shopping at Whole Foods. And yeah, apparently they've been divorced since 2009 and she's been a lesbian for a while. And she has changed her whole look. Like, she now looks like, I wouldn't say like full butch, but definitely androgynous, definitely no longer wearing like strappy sandals and flouncy vintage skirts and stuff.
Not that I see a late in life lesbian arc for myself, but there is something aspirational about like completely doing a 180 on your style.
Totally. It's also impacted her styling work. Like, I went back and like looked through her Instagram and what she's been doing lately. And like, yeah, she's definitely done a lot of shoots that are more androgynous. We should clarify, she is one of the most legendary stylists. She was sort of in the Margiela crew in the 90s. She'd worked for Marc by Marc Jacobs for a really long time and did pretty much like everything for them from the beginning. She, you know, has done a lot of editorial work in like British magazines, In the Face, Self-Service, magazines like that. And now she is styling for McQueen with Sean McGurr.
All right.
So she's such a legend, and she's dating literally the hottest woman ever, who was actually recently in a J.W. Anderson campaign.
So should we get into this question, because Alice Temple is the connecting person, which is, have you read Say Everything by Ione Skye, especially the bits about Jenny Shimizu?
Did you finish it? Because I read that book like when it came out.
I haven't finished it. I've gotten up to the Jenny Shimizu part.
Sounds really, really hot, I have to say. Ione Skye, like, dated the coolest, hottest women in the 90s. Jenny Shimizu, Ingrid Casares, famously linked to Madonna, Sandra Bernhard, and Alice Temple as well.
Between Anthony Kiedis' Scar Tissue, Kathleen Hanna's memoir, and then Ione Skye's Say Everything, just like triangulating all of the stories and anecdotes of how they overlap with each other.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to witness all of this, truly. But Ione Skye's book is very, very good. It's well written. She was very enmeshed in some pivotal moments in culture, whether it was kind of her childhood growing up in Los Angeles and Donovan being her father, kind of hanging out with a lot of Nepo babies and children of rock stars, and, you know, then being, of course, a very successful actor in the 80s and in that sort of brat pack world.
Brat Pack adjacent. Her memoir is such a interesting subgenre of celebrity memoirs where, this is not to denigrate her at all, but like, she might not be a household name, she is to us, but she is intersected with so many interesting moments. She was friends with River Phoenix, she starred in River's Edge with Keanu Reeves, she dated Anthony Kiedis when she was 16 and he was 24. Ooh.
She was also very enmeshed in the fashion scene in the 90s.
She was married to a Beastie Boy.
Yeah, there's a lot of goss in this book.
But like, again, not A-plus level goss, like A-plus level goss to us.
I think it's A-plus level goss.
Hearing that, you know, her safe word with Jenny Shimizu was London, like that is life altering for me, at least.
Absolutely. Most people would have taken all of that to the grave, to our detriment.
The memoir we need, but we'll never get, is from Jenny Shimizu.
Well, and from Ad Rock. Then we would fully...
Oh, then we would get the full picture? Yeah.
We need Jenny and Ad Rock to complete this Kurosawa-esque...
Rashomon of the situation. Of Gen X rock.
Gen X situation. Anyway.
Sorry, you had on the docket thoughts on the Ventmont menswear show, which is this under Celesbian News because Sharon Stone closed the show wearing a suit and a tie?
I was more referring to like the first 10 looks of the show, but yes, also Sharon Stone. It was a very lesbian show. They cast a lot of lesbians, including one of Camille Bedeau Waddington's exes. I'll get into that with you later. My friend Arda, who's a fabulous model, was in that show. They cast, like, I don't think I've ever seen this many actual lesbians cast in a single fashion show before.
Yeah, I thought the fashion was good, but the casting was excellent in a way that I haven't noticed the casting of a show in a while.
I think I appreciated the first section of the show because, like, they did a good high fashion version of sort of contemporary lesbian fashion tropes and, you know, with also, of course, some like 90s lesbian fashion trope throwbacks and stuff, which is how everyone dresses now. But the middle section, I didn't really care about. Also, I do think it's funny that Sharon Stone was cast in the show. I thought she looked incredible. Because, like, remember how in Demna's, maybe not the last Gucci show, but the one before, there was, like, the Basic Instinct dress?
Right, that Laura Harrier wore to the New York Cruise show.
Yes, I feel like him casting Sharon Stone in this Ventmont show is, like, a continuation of this, like, incredibly stupid and immature beef that he has with his much more talented brother.
Who's the more talented brother? Demna?
Obviously.
Okay.
But, you know, good on Garam for pulling out some solid lesbian chic looks. I loved the sort of reverse tie. I can see people actually buying that.
All right. Let's get into another call.
Hi, girls. I am a day one listener. I think of myself as a Lauren Sunstein with like maybe a Paul Moon. So naturally, my question is for Chelsea. Chelsea, did you ever watch or know anyone on The Real L Word, the reality show version? I think two scenarios are likely. Either you never watched it, very possible, or you were low-key on it and you simply want to, like, repress this part of your life. Love you both. Think you're hot and smart. Bye.
I'm obsessed with this call. I love this idea that you were on The Real L Word and you don't want anyone to know.
The answer to that question is, I don't know if I was on The Real L Word, because back in the day when I lived in Brooklyn, I do remember going to a lesbian party where they happened to be filming that show, but that would have been later in The Real L Word's run, like after I had stopped watching the show. So could I be in the background of a scene on The Real L Word? Definitely yes. But I have no idea.
So you know of the show, you've watched it, but you fell off during the later seasons.
Yes, I fell off, I think, mid-season two. But I think every millennial-aged lesbian watched season one, for sure. And I have met many of the cast members over the years. I did meet Whitney maybe 10 years ago, 12 years ago, at a lesbian bar in Atlanta. Shout out to my sister's room. And very recently, I met Rose from The Real L Word, which was the other, like, super iconic character. But it had been so long since I watched the show that I didn't, like, put two and two together. And then my friend sent me one of Rose's Instagram stories and was like, is this you? And I was like, oh my God. I knew she looked familiar.
So there you go. All right, to round out the lesbian section of this mailbag episode, favorite butch fashion icons. I feel like I am disqualified from answering this question. One, because I'm straight. And two, because when I searched, is Paula Poundstone a butch? I was alerted that she does not identify as queer. So I'll let Chelsea answer this.
Okay, I'm just going to say literally everyone that Ione Skye and Camille Bedeau Waddington have dated. Radcliffe Hall and Katie Lang are, I would say, the quintessential butch fashion icons. But the problem is, it's like a lot of butch women and studs aren't like fashionistas. You know what I mean? An exception to this rule would be someone like Mikalene Thomas, who like always has some sort of Dover Street Market drip happening. And then there are people like, I would say, like a Fran Lebowitz or a Edwige Belmore, who is like a lesbian punk icon. They wear menswear, but I wouldn't describe them as butch. You know what I mean? Like, no one's like mistaking Fran Lebowitz for a man.
Right.
So I feel like there are people like that, that kind of like the style is there, but like the full gender presentation, maybe I wouldn't describe that way.
Okay. Some questions that really don't fit into any other category. Starting with, please explain what the Valley is.
Lauren, take it away.
The Valley can mean so many things. Geographically, it is a region located in Los Angeles County that encompasses neighborhoods like Studio City, Encino, Sherman Oaks, Tarzana, Reseda, Woodland Hills, Chatsworth. I grew up in Laurel Canyon, but I consider myself a Valley girl. I went to school in the Valley. All my friends lived in the Valley. It's where I've spent the majority of my life. But the Valley is also a state of mind. It's the closest you'll get to suburbia or a main street in Los Angeles. It's chiller, there's a ton of parking, so naturally I'm in a better mood when I'm in this area. However, there is also the Vanderpump spinoff show called The Valley, which I have not watched. But it seems like those that got famous on Lisa Vanderpump's show acquired enough money that they could not buy homes in West Hollywood, but they could afford The Valley.
Love that for them. The Valley's great. I would happily live in the Valley.
Oh, yeah. The Valley, especially Studio City, Sherman Oaks, has gotten very chic in the past few years.
Even the parts that aren't chic, like the vibes are good. I run most of my errands in the Valley. I spend most of my time, I guess, Sherman Oaks, Studio City, but a beautiful place. If you live here, not if you're a tourist, like who cares? I mean, go to Casa Vega or something, but
we really have stoked the parasocial fires, because it's like, if you want to potentially run into us, it would most likely be in the Valley.
I run into fuckettes in the Valley all the time.
Oh, wow.
All right, next call.
Hey, Lauren and Chelsea, what's up? This is MC. It's my second time calling. I've got a question for y'all. I just turned 29, so this is the last year of my 20s. What would you guys say are some important things that I need to leave behind this year and not take with me into my 30s? Is it vaping? Is it like IKEA furnishings? Is it TikTok? I don't know. I just want to be classy and cool in my 30s, but I still want to have fun. So let me know what you think. Love you both so much. Bye.
Okay, definitely quit vaping. No judgment, obviously. I've been there. But it is true that the longer that you do something, the harder it is to quit. Do I take this advice myself? Absolutely not. But you should.
I was going to say, if I think about what I fixated on in my 20s that hopefully I let go of in my 30s was comparing where you are in life personally or professionally to other people in your peer group. Like, I definitely spent most of my 20s obsessing where friends were in their careers and why I wasn't there and they got this opportunity. Certainly when I was pursuing more of a career in the entertainment industry. And, you know, a decade on from that time period, I've come to realize, like, it all evens out.
Yeah.
And so it's a lot of wasted time to spend obsessing on where other people are in their lives versus where you are.
But this is true of literally every age.
I know, but it's something that I did more in my 20s than totally. I let go of in my 30s, because I did see like, oh, we all kind of ended up around the same place.
I do want to address her comment about potentially giving up IKEA furnishings. I don't think that is entirely possible in this economy. But what I would say, you should give up on the IKEA stuff that is made out of particle board. If you guys take away nothing else from this episode, let it be this. Do not buy that particle board shit. It breaks. It doesn't work. Adults do not need the problems that particle board will bring into their lives. So maybe when you're at IKEA, look for stuff that is made out of wood, metal, glass, those sorts of materials. And of course, make sure that the ratio of IKEA, no more than 40%, although that's a little high, I would say. I think for your 30s, it should be more like 30% IKEA.
It goes by age. I guess that wouldn't work. No, in your 40s, you'd have 40%. But I do think IKEA accessories, eternal. Like, use IKEA to kind of dress up the place.
There's always something to find at IKEA. Always. If nothing else, those meatballs.
Which Paul recently took Morty to the Culver City IKEA, which is a smaller IKEA, which you would think would be cool. But as he explained, it's not good. The whole point of IKEA is it's gigantic and you get to go into all the fake rooms and then you figure out what you want. And then you go downstairs or to a warehouse area and you get the stuff. And he was like, there's none of that. It's all mixed together and there's no meatballs.
That sounds horrible. Although I guess that does prevent that awful IKEA situation where you found everything that you need. Then you go downstairs to pick it up and like nothing's there. So then you have to go back up like through every single fake room and find your like second choice shit.
Maybe leave IKEA behind in your 30s. Maybe you are correct. Okay, this question seems made for Chelsea. Palm Spring recommendations going at the end of July. I know this fuckette got a great hotel deal if they're going at the end of July.
I think July is a great time to go to Palm Springs. It is very hot. But there are a wealth of very expensive, very nice hotels in Palm Springs that are cheap in the hottest months. So you can stay somewhere really nice. And the thing about Palm Springs is like, you're not like walking around on the streets of Palm Springs like it's New York or something. Like you don't do shit. You lay by a pool, like you go to an antique store that you drive to, like it's not that deep. But recommendations. We went recently, I would say for shopping, it's Market Market, which is basically just like a indoor flea market kind of scenario.
That several vintage dealers have space in. Like one of our favorite vintage stores, the Frippery, has moved in there. That's how we learned about it.
Yeah. Also, when we were there last time, they basically had an insane amount of archival Jeremy Scott. Like, I think he had just like come through and dropped off like every single collection he ever made. It was like a museum show, basically. I looked through everything. It was amazing. So go there. Modern Way is the best furniture store. And in the same strip mall that Modern Way is in, there are other good furniture stores. So check that out. Restaurants are hard in Palm Springs. The restaurants are worse than you would think. I would say that important ones, Bar Cecil, hard to get into, but figure it out.
We happened to get a reservation because literally we drove up like 2 hours before they opened and got a table.
You can show up when they open and you can possibly get a table, but they release reservations 2 weeks in advance for whatever the date is. So that's how that worked. The restaurant was inspired by Cecil Beaton, so obviously we approve. Mr. Lyons is the classic steakhouse. The Parker Palm Springs is the best hotel. And within that, there are multiple restaurants. I would say the most essential being Norma's, which is like a good place to go for lunch or for brunch.
More specifically, it has your favorite dish in the world, I think.
Yes, which is like this insane lox bagel that's like, they slice the bagel into a million tiny pieces and like stack it up kind of like a shish kebab almost. It's crazy, but it's incredible. And what else? Oh, the flea market is good. That happens once a month if it happens to be on when you're in town.
I don't think it is. I believe it's one of the rare flea markets that's like we only run from September to May. It's not during the hot months.
That flea market is where I bought my most worn t-shirt, which is that Cramps shirt with the dominatrixes on it that I always wear.
Oh, that's where you got that?
That is where I got it. Or that's where Tat got it and I stole it from her. And then obviously Palm Springs is in relatively close proximity to the Cabazon Outlet Mall, which is the most essential shopping thing.
Yeah, it's unclear from this question if you are visiting Southern California in general. And so you're driving from Los Angeles to Palm Springs. If you are, the Cabazon outlets are on the way in or out. If you are flying directly into Palm Springs, which is, by the way, a fabulous regional airport.
With a really great bust of Sonny Bono, who used to be the mayor of Palm Springs.
Oh,
on a related note, the other thing you should do, Liberace had a house in Palm Springs that
yes.
is very close to the sort of main strip. And you should just go drive by, take a gander. It's fab. I also do like just sort of driving around through the more affluent neighborhoods in Palm Springs and looking at the incredible mid-century houses. So it's like the closer you get to the mountains, the more expensive the houses get. So check it out.
Okay. Thoughts on dating someone that does drugs, parentheses, coke and ket, from time to time? It's still the early stage. Depends on what time to time means. Is that time the weekend or is it like a Tuesday?
Yeah, the frequency of the drug use is important because frequency directly relates to the level of dependency that this person has. But like, from my perspective, like YOLO, I think that occasional recreational drug use is totally normal. So maybe I'm not the best person to ask.
I also think this is an age-dependent question. Is this person in their 20s? Then totally. 30s? Go for it. 40s? I'd like to think that this is a every once in a while thing. 50s? Getting a little dicey.
What, you can't do a bump in your 50s? Who made you the mayor of Palm Springs?
Well, I was going to say that I feel that drug use and age is kind of like a horseshoe because as you get older, I do think it's cooler to occasionally do drugs. Like if one of our friends was dating some 60 or 70-year-old who occasionally did coke, I'd be like, that's cool.
Yeah. Although doing coke like all the time, like for your whole life, like it does literally like change people's brains.
Oh yeah, it does fuck with your brain chemistry, but I think you're fine.
But the fact that you are even asking us this question isn't the greatest indicator because to me it suggests that like on some level that you are uncomfortable with their drug use or think it could be a problem.
Yeah.
I don't know if it is a problem, but it seems like you might not totally be on the same page.
Give it a couple months. I think you need more, especially because you stated that it's still the early stages of dating. I think you need more sample data.
How long has he been in that K-hole?
And will he ever get out? Yeah, she didn't clarify. She wasn't like, you know, he did miss a date once because he was stuck in a K-hole. In that case, you might want to break up with him.
Okay, we are now joined by a very special guest. She's the editor-in-chief of Polyester Magazine, and her new book, The Polyester Book of Bad Taste, is out now. Welcome to the pod, Ione Gamble.
Hi, thank you for having me.
All right, I want to get into your work at Polyester and the new book, but we have a few more questions from listeners. Are you down to get into them?
Absolutely.
Okay, this first one is pretty controversial. Thoughts on clavicular opening 424's recent fashion show? You're a fan, right?
Oh, huge clavicular fan.
Who isn't?
Gina was saying the other day, she was like, oh, I'm actually like a scholar on clavicular and I don't know how I've got here. I was like, because we did one podcast episode and now we've fed him so much. But I think what I enjoyed about him doing Paris Fashion Week is that no one cared. Like, it didn't have the same impact as like Elena Velez at New York Fashion Week. Like, it kind of just happened in Europe and everyone was like, okay, fine, whatever. We don't care about this man, which I think was probably very humbling for him.
True, but I did hear about this brand for the first time, which I had absolutely no aware of.
No idea.
They have a store in LA on Melrose.
Yeah, that checks out. I mean, I did see backlash and sort of like online commentary of like, shame on you. But I think that distracted from the fact that he is a very bad model who cannot walk. And if that message got out instead of like, how dare you put him in your fashion show, that would have shamed him properly that he would never interact with fashion ever again.
I hope not, but we'll see.
Yeah, he's walked in two more fashion shows than I expected him to. Will there be a third?
I feel like his time is dying out, right? Like, people haven't paid as much attention this time as they did for the Elena Velez show. I feel like the shock factor's gone.
See, I don't know if I'm on a different side of the internet than you, but I feel like this got more attention than when he walked at Elena Velez.
Because it's Paris?
Maybe. Although I feel like this brand is less major, but I think it's like one of those hype beast labels where they're like trying to make actual clothes,
mm-hmm.
but the clothes are like kind of where other people's ideas go to die. Like, I went to their website and they had a very questionable Rolling Stones collaboration.
Oh my God. So
it's on the John Varvatos spectrum in that way.
So it's basically for the boys. Maybe it was more in his target audience.
I don't know. Hopefully this is his last fashion show, but I feel like there is a high probability that he could enter into the Vetmont universe at some point, but we shall see.
He's definitely going to walk Vetmont. I can see him doing a big show.
Dolce & Gabbana.
Oh, perhaps. For sure. He's going to be a Dolce boy. Oh my God, hell.
I would actually like to see that. Like, if he got the full Dolce & Gabbana beat, yeah. Like the full men's makeover, then I might care.
Yeah.
Okay, from fashion magazine collector to fashion magazine collector, what are your favorites in your magazine collection?
So I've recently, I mean, after I came to Chelsea and Tatiana's house in March, I've been revitalizing my collection because I threw them all away in like a various house move. The first ones I bought back were all of the Lula magazines before Leith Clark sold it, which was like a very interesting thing to look back on because it was so formative for me when I bought them when I was like 11, 12, 13. And interestingly, they don't hold up as well as my memory serves.
Oh, I believe that. I felt the same thing about Nylon magazine when yes. I went back to look at the early issues. I was like, what was I thinking?
Yes.
Although Lula was cool in the sense that it had such a strong perspective.
Mm-hmm. It was the Twee Girl magazine, right? Like, there's no taking it away from that. And it went so far downhill when it was sold. I mean, interestingly, you say Nylon because I bought back some Nylons as well from like when I was first reading it. And I have like a Young Hollywood issue that was in collaboration with MySpace. And I was like, this is actually amazing. Like, you never see anyone do like a brand or a social media platform do anything interesting, like sponsor a whole issue. And it was just like fun and interesting. And I love seeing like how low their budgets were for portraits. Like, they literally were just going around the back of an alley and taking pictures of people that are now like mega famous. So I did enjoy that.
Oh, their budgets were low. I know a lot of people that worked there and oh my God, those salaries back in 2005.
Let's not even get into the freelancers who I'm sure still haven't been paid from 15 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. And then I also bought, on your recommendation, Chelsea, loads of Nova magazine, but from the relaunch in the early 2000s,
yes.
Which I feel like is actually incredible. And feels so timely to now. Like, it could, all of these issues could be now. And I even got, like, with the second issue, they sent out like a vest that was like, read Nova magazine in like a little hand drawn thing. And I got one of them and I was like, this is what magazines should be. Like, the beauty was so amazing. It integrated shopping in a way that I feel magazines don't do anymore. Like, they're also high end and like books. What happened to a good shopping page? Like, bring back the shopping page.
Totally.
See, for me, I have my whole first run of Lula magazine, which I don't know how that magazine came on my radar, but I used to have to go to a gay porn bookshop in Silver Lake because they were the only ones that stocked it.
Amazing.
I also have like a near complete collection of French Vogue at the height of Karin Reutfeld.
Wow.
From like 2004 to 2006, because I somehow convinced my parents as a Christmas present to get me a subscription.
Okay, that is the best and nerdiest thing to ask your parents for.
But for me, what I'm collecting now when it comes to magazines is just buying back old issues of Us Weekly from the early 2000s.
Perfect.
Speaking of like a shopping page, stars, they're just like us. Like, that's what I'm nostalgic for now.
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
Have you two heard of, I feel like it was very, very British, but another magazine that was like so formative to me that I haven't been able to get is Super Super. Have you guys heard of that one?
No, actually.
It was like a new rave magazine and it was like pre-Vice's big explosion and it had like MIA on the cover. It had like all of these British musicians and fashion people on the cover and the layout. It's kind of like Polyester but times 200. Like, there's 200 conflicting images on one page. It had like all of these like little club features. Everyone's wearing like a tape deck on a big plastic chain. Like, it was very of that time, but I've never been able to buy back a copy.
I need to check that out. I definitely missed that one.
I don't know how widely it was available.
I have so many magazines that, like, I don't even know what my favorites would be. Although I have been buying a lot of, like, best and worst dressed issues of, like, People and the National Enquirer. Like, that is what I am into presently. Mm-hmm.
We need more.
All right, next question. Have rich people become worse dressers?
Yes.
It feels like they have.
Okay, yes and no. Because I think who we associate as the super wealthy are, of course, tech billionaires, like a Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. And certainly there's a Silicon Valley uniform that is not great. A lot of vests. And I think that Steve Jobs gave us a false impression that these tech oligarchs have taste, but he, I think, was the only one that had taste.
I can agree more.
They all look bad, but I feel like just like run-of-the-mill rich people, maybe I don't have the best framework for this because I didn't really like grow up in that sort of company. But I do think on the whole, like logomania has been a very destructive thing for the 1%. It obviously works for some people, like, you know, NBA players and stuff. But like the average bitch on Rodeo, I don't know.
Yeah, I completely agree. I feel like all of the extremely rich people I know that aren't in fashion are just logo people.
So, Ione, we got a lot of questions from our listeners about how to not be a basic bride. And then there was a follow-up question, which is the Vivian Westwood wedding dress over? And I think they're specifically referring to the wedding dress I wore that Charlie XCX also wore.
I think that Taylor Swift is going to wear Vivian Westwood.
I think so, too. I think the Tortured Poets section of the Eras Tour was an indication of things to come.
That's going to be like the death knell for the dress, unfortunately, Lauren. We're going to have to renew the vows.
Oh, that's so true. You're going to have to burn yours.
Yeah.
Oh, no. That dress is completely overdone. I loved wearing it. However, if I was getting married this summer, this year, next year, I don't think I would have chosen that dress. I also just want to point out, there are other Vivian Westwood wedding dresses available.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about your wedding look, which was really amazing and very like non-traditional. Who designed your dress?
So my dress was designed by Edward Meadham, who used to have the line Meadham Kirchhoff, who I've known since I started polyester because he did like an open casting for the last Meadham Kirchhoff show. And I like ran in like, please look at my zine. And then we made friends.
Oh, amazing.
It was very short. It was a baby doll. It was actually modeled on like an Anna Sui dress from the 90s with these like cape sleeves. It was in a blue, baby blue moiré with bright yellow lace, which was interesting because I'm not very like a color person in that way. But when Ed said he would like to design it, I was like, you do what you think I would want. And then when I saw it, I was like, yeah. I had a really short veil as well, like a mini veil. It was very kind of like Priscilla Presley through, I guess, like a John Waters gaze, which I guess also kind of sums me up.
Perfect. I love Meadham Kirchhoff so much. I have one Meadham Kirchhoff thing and it's like an insane tiara. I think from that one like Courtney Love collection. It has like unicorns on it and shit.
Oh my God, I need to see it next time I see you. Please just wear it.
Never wore it. Bought it on sale because I felt like I had to. Maybe its time will come one of these days.
Oh, please. Hopefully we're going to do a polyester LA party this year. So if we do one, you can wear it to that. It would be the perfect place.
Perfect. I'll finally have the right place to wear it.
Exactly. Like where it's meant to be.
But I think what you did for your wedding dress is the key to not being a basic bride. I think a pop of color, I think an unconventional length, which is what I did, a shorter dress. Mm-hmm. I think perhaps sourcing from different sources, you know, maybe a vintage skirt, a modern top.
Okay, but is it more unconventional to be conventional at this point?
Ooh.
Food for thought. Putting it out there.
Yeah, I think also it's so appealing to like look on Instagram and the weddings that everyone else is doing. And I think that's just the way you can have a basic wedding, right? Like thinking about whatever you actually want and what feels most like you. Like I got married like down the road from me in like a little community cafe that was really cheap, but had a massive smoking area because I was like, everyone we know, including our family, smokes. So there has to be a huge smoking area. I think just thinking in that way will lead you to not basic decisions. Exactly.
Okay, next question. Is it time to admit that Alessandro Michele has been a flop at Valentino? Interesting. I personally don't think he's been a flop. I think he actually did the impossible, which is design a good updated version of the rock stud sandal.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree that I don't feel like people are actually wearing the clothes.
I agree. And I think that's a shame because the clothes are actually really nice. Like when you go on the website, you're like, I would wear a lot of it. I think maybe where it's fallen down is when he was at Gucci, like the marketing was so excellent. And he like got all of these people around him, like different celebrity ambassadors or like his work with Petra Collins, like different artists, unskilled worker that really like helped make Gucci that moment for him. Whereas this time, I don't think we've seen strength in the celebrity ambassadors or in the marketing or in the like activations, media placements, like it hasn't really made an impact in that way.
Yeah, that's true. I don't really think of any celebrities as being associated with Valentino right now necessarily.
No, not at all.
Yeah, I was going to say a flop to whom? Because I imagine the Alessandro Michele Gucci woman just went over to Valentino. I think the issue might be how many people can afford a $27,000 Valentino dress?
Mm-hmm.
Totally. I will say Lauren and I went in the Valentino outlet in Palm Springs pretty recently, and it was kind of shocking because there was like entire collections in there. There was like the first look, the last look, like crazy shit. So
it's on deep, deep sale on the outlet. Like the same thing. All of the collection is on the outlet.
Yeah, it's sad. But I think also a lot of the reason why people felt compelled to buy Gucci was the logo.
Mm-hmm.
And the stripe and all of that sort of stuff, which Valentino just does not have that built into the brand in the same way. They didn't have like bags that were like really major ever, I think, you know?
Agree.
I do love this question because it's like a hive mind question, which is, are we pro jelly shoes?
I'm curious what you think, Ione.
I saw this and I've thought about it really long and really hard. Like, in my heart, I'm pro-jelly. In my head, I'm not, because they are so fucking uncomfortable, especially in the summer. Like, it's just blisters all the time. Like, I love the little Chloe Princess ones, but they're also £500.
Yeah.
And I don't like it enough. And I think any other, I hate like a flat jelly. And I think I'm also too scarred from the Melissa Westwood collaborations at their height and everyone having them. And they're ugly.
Yeah, I think a Melissa shoe is really hit or miss. I think the Y Project ones were good.
So gorgeous.
But like, it really depends. And yeah, I agree with you. I think wearing a jelly sandal, it borders on self-harm sometimes, you know? Like, I think it's a beach-only situation. The idea of wearing like a jelly shoe on a hot New York City street, like, legitimately disgusts me.
Tessa Thompson was just photographed in those Chloe Princess heels walking, I think, on Bowery in New York City in like 80 degree weather. And I was like, how?
Oh, she's in pain.
That's fine because she can wear them once, you know?
Yeah, I guess I'm pro jelly shoe. I'm just anti-luxury jelly shoe. Like when the Row first did the jelly fisherman shoes for $900, or maybe they were $1,200, I was like, in what world?
It's just like, buy something better, buy something else, buy something that will actually hold up.
Okay, next question. What trend is everyone pretending to like? For one, I would say quiet luxury.
That's what I was gonna say.
Well, because quiet luxury, it's like a lifestyle thing where it's like, that's how your apartment has to look. Also, I don't think a lot of these girls are really like committing to the full lifestyle.
I've also been clocking these bitches because quiet luxury obviously has been a trend for the last few years. I'm seeing a lot of them wearing some color now. And I'm like, no, you bought into the trend. And look, I bought into the trend. And after buying a bunch of beige pieces of clothing, I realized, oh no, I actually want to dress more eccentric.
I also have talked about this before, but I do think that a lot of these very femmy straight women that are wearing suits with button-down shirts and like full straight ties are going to like look back at these photos and be like, why the fuck do I look like Paula Poundstone? You know, do you have her in the UK? Is that like a reference understood?
No. Who is she?
She is a stand-up comedian that was big in the 90s. A straight woman, but this was like her look.
Oh, these are the kind of things you're meant to work out when you're like a teenager or in your early 20s. You're like, you're either the type of woman that can wear a suit like that or you're not. And I realized very early on, no, I will always look like that lovely comedian. It's not for me.
Okay, so I want to get into your new book, The Polyester Book of Bad Taste, which is a collection of essays that you edited. You also wrote a couple of essays in this book. What made you decide to center the book around the theme of taste?
So polyester, in some ways, has always been about taste. So I studied fashion journalism and we had a project where it was like, you have to launch a publication. And when I was thinking of what I wanted to do, it was kind of during like peak Tumblr, and like peak Miedem Kirchhoff, peak Louise Gray, all of these like big London designers that were really working with maximalism and femininity. And I found the John Waters quote, have faith in your own bad taste, and was like, oh, that's it. Like at the time I was being taught, like much like we are now, that, you know, like quiet luxury is the way to express intelligence in fashion, also that you're to be taken seriously as a person. And it was not something that I aligned with at all. So I wanted to do the opposite and kind of celebrate parts of fashion and pop culture and visual culture that were considered low taste and interrogate the reasons why and kind of prove that they can be intellectual or as rigorous as other things that we just associate with that anyway. So I think it was like natural to want to explore taste in that way, because through the magazine itself, it's much more about platforming people or like designers or films and things that kind of just represent that ethos without actually being like, what is taste? So when I was thinking about what I wanted my next book to be, I knew that I wanted to kind of center it around taste and what that means, especially as it seems so much more fraught than when I started Polyester in 2014, because of where we have kind of come to in the internet with algorithms, influencers, and constantly having our taste delineated to us via trends, I guess.
I guess your book begs the question, is it even possible to have taste anymore since we're so easily influenced by everything we see on our phone?
I think it's much more difficult. I think, and I can't even imagine how much more difficult it would be if you were like a younger person, like someone in their teens or 20s, how much more difficult it would be to kind of foster a sense of taste that feels like subversive or transgressive, because the internet that we kind of came onto either as teenagers or young adults just doesn't exist anymore.
I loved in the book, in one of your essays, you talk about how taste is something that you acquire, right? And mm-hmm. you use this metaphor of the Russian doll of like, you see a movie, you love the soundtrack, you know, you then like an artist from that soundtrack, you buy their album, you find out who the costume designer is. And I don't know when it comes to fashion, if that exists anymore. I feel like those that are cinephiles and like on Letterboxd, that kind of Russian doll, finding the next thing, finding the influence exists. But I don't know if it exists in fashion today, because we get so many questions of like, I'm into fashion, where do I even begin?
I think with fashion, it's like particularly depressing, because I feel like the internet in the beginning for fashion was like so ripe with different criticism and like runway reviews and different critics. And now they're either paywalled or more difficult to find, or your first kind of brushing with fashion isn't going to be through going on like Vogue runway. It's going to be through an influencer that is most likely being paid to talk about that brand. We find out so much less because of that. Like, yeah, I couldn't tell you who soundtracked a show unless you're like looking for ages. And it just becomes more about shopping. And obviously, like, we love shopping. I love shopping. But I equally love finding out every single thing there is to know about a collection, or like pulling out my own references, seeing if they match up to what was on the press release. And even though we're shown so much information, we actually have less knowledge about everything.
Totally. But also, a lot of people that are like fashion commentators online, the frame of reference is very short, and it kind of begins like when fashion shows started to be on the internet, which would mm-hmm. be the early 2000s. Yeah, it's a different game now. It really is. I feel really lucky to have grown up in the time that I did, and honestly, to have my tastes more influenced by magazine editors than anyone else, you know?
I completely agree. And I think I was talking to someone about this, and it's that like now, because I refer to influencers as like a new class, like a new social class of people. But really, I think what I mean is they've kind of replaced editors. Like, obviously, I'm an editor. I hope that that's not the case. But as in like, in terms of who people look up to or want to emulate or want to be or want to get a career in, that would be influencers now, because they're so much more visible.
Yeah, it's sad, but it's true. Speaking of editors, Lauren and I have always been big fans of Tavi Gevinson, who wrote a really great essay in your book. She, of course, edited Rookie, which was so influential. Can you talk about your relationship with her, and do you feel a kinship with her as an editor?
Yeah, I mean, so Tavi was actually one of our first polyester cover girls, and we had some like crossover, I guess, in contributors, like early polyester, and Rookie was very established by the time I started polyester. And I found out through a contributor that she was coming to London to like launch the Pirelli calendar. Do you remember when they did like a feminist Pirelli calendar?
Yes. Truly the funniest thing ever.
And she was in it. And so this contributor was like, oh, do you want to shoot her? And I was like, obviously, yes. We had like 2 days. We called up like a club in where I live, Peckham, and we're like, can we shoot in here? Tavi turned up with like a driver who used to be like our prime minister's driver and a boot full of Chanel. And I was like, it was like the coolest thing I've ever seen in my whole life. We did the shoot in like 3 hours, and then we just stayed in touch. I think obviously because we both ran publications, I look up to her in many ways. Like, she's had such a like broad career and like is so smart, knows so much about everything. I think her essay for the book is amazing as well, because she's always had such a clear point of view but hasn't been that reflective on that time in her life. And I feel like the essay kind of gives us a glimpse into that, and also just like her commentary on these things, like, oh, I grew up with all of these pieces of culture that shaped me, how do I reckon with the fact that that might have been problematic, or that I have complicated feelings towards it, which is what the essay does.
Totally. I too had a VHS copy of Almost Famous at some point in my life.
I think we all did. Like, it's so funny, like one of our contributing editors is like a gay man, and he was like, I can't believe how much all of you refer to Almost Famous in this book. Like, I watched it once, didn't care for it, and put it back down. Like, what was going on with all of you girls?
Is it really bad? I feel like it might be. Like, I haven't seen it since I was a teenager.
My husband had never seen Almost Famous, and I'm a Cameron Crowe girly. I mean, everything prior to Elizabethtown, and I had not seen Almost Famous in, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years, and I tried showing it to him, and he literally just walked out of the room. Not because it was bad, but it just couldn't carry his attention. He's like, I don't care about this.
I think it's good. I will say, I haven't watched it in like 5 years. But when I watched it, but it was nostalgia, obviously. I was like, I love it still.
Well, I think that Almost Famous came back into the zeitgeist when that Daisy Jones and the Six series came out, because people compared stills of Almost Famous to that. And they were like, why does Almost Famous look authentically from the 70s and this show does not?
Well, Daisy Jones and the Six was terrible. But again, I loved it. I watched it all. I have such a low bar.
My feelings exactly about Daisy Jones and the Six. Although I will say, at least they did make a great fake song that was their big song, which a lot of movies like with fictional rock bands cannot do.
I would like more fake songs in general.
I mean, shout out to Nancy Wilson, who was Cameron Crowe's wife at the time, who was from the band Heart, because she worked with all of those actors and then wrote the band was Stillwater? And
yeah.
No one remembers those songs. We remember Tiny Dancer. That movie introduced Elton John to a whole new generation.
And thank God.
Anyway, back to this fabulous book that you wrote. I love Kat Cohen's essay about her sheltered religious upbringing and how it robbed her of those formative years of falling in love with culture and developing her own taste. It made me really thankful that my parents gave me unlimited internet and cable television time. But it made me curious what your formative cultural obsessions were. Like, what changed you forever?
So I was really lucky that I grew up in Brighton, which is like a very liberal city in the UK that's on the beach, and it's like the gay capital of the UK as well. So I feel like I was introduced to a lot of things quite early. But for me, I remember being like 11 years old and walking around like the town centre, and used to just be able to pick up all these magazines for free. So I picked up like Vice. And do you remember, it's that cover where it's a girl on the beach and she's like lighting a cigarette and her lighter's over her boob? That was like the first like adult magazine I picked up, and I feel like that unlocked a lot for me. And similarly, I don't think he ever made it across the pond, but there was this like indie era gay musician called Patrick Wolf, which neither of you have probably ever heard of.
Never heard of that. But I did read a lot of British magazines growing up, so I'm surprised.
He was in a Burberry campaign with Agnes Dean.
Okay, I do remember this Burberry campaign.
So I feel like liking him kind of opened fashion up to me in that way as well. But also it was like 11, 12, 13 during like big peak Cara Delevingne, indie in British fashion, and like, yeah, these brands that were kind of coming out of Central St. Mind's, Fashion East starting, and that was all like very accessible, not just via the internet but via fashion magazine. So I feel like that's kind of what unlocked it all for me.
Yeah, it must be nice to grow up in close proximity to a city that was such a cultural hub, you know, of fashion, especially at that time. Are we talking about like the House of Holland era?
Big House of Holland era. Like, I bought like the nail decals, the tights, like anything I could buy, all of the Topshop collaborations, anything that was like a high street designer mashup I was buying or like trying to buy. I really wanted the Christopher Kane crocodile dress for my prom dress, but I couldn't afford it.
Oh, of course. All of that Christopher Kane stuff, the gorilla dress, like it's all so burned into my brain.
Yeah, it's that era for me. I feel like all of those things, and it was like music and fashion had such a close connection in the UK in particular that like I was just obsessed with.
Yeah, that period was so interesting too, because it was like the first time that I was metabolizing fashion content like those Christopher Kane collections through blogs instead of through magazines.
Yeah, for sure.
Which now it's just kind of, I don't know, it's a different game.
I think that like, for example, yeah, like blogs editorialized fashion in the same way a magazine did, right? Like Susie Bubble, Tavi, all of those early era bloggers were really also editorializing their work, whereas now we're just getting the clothes and the influencers as they are.
Well, I could talk about mid-aughts British fashion with you all day, but unfortunately we have to wrap things up. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ione. We wanted to have you on the pod forever, and this has been fab.
Oh, thank you for having me. What a dream come true.
And thank you also to everyone who submitted questions. If we didn't get to your questions, they may be answered on our VIP mailbag episode that is coming out in a few days. Until then, bye guys.
Bye.
Bye.